Beans, Couch, and Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new movies, Book Club, The Next Chapter, Blackberry, Rally Road Racers, The Mother, and Crater. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the 1977 TV movie, The Hobbit. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First off in the news, let's take a look at the box office and the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 won, and it won handily. It made good money. It's not $200 million. It wasn't over what Doctor Strange or Thor Love and Thunder did. And of course, everybody immediately, you hear that, and people are like, oh, superhero fatigue. Let's address that. The estimates on Sunday were $113 million, and then it turned out the actuals were over $118 million, which shows an uptick. Usually when you see that happen, that's good for the movie. That shows it has legs, has more staying power, as opposed to Quantumania, which I enjoyed, but that one did not have the widest appeal. But then again, the Ant-Man movies have never had the widest appeal in the Marvel canon. Guardians of the Galaxy have done well, but they've not done Iron Man well. Let's just put it that way. So $118 million for this third movie that still has a somewhat undefined new phase in the Marvel universe, that's perfectly great. This movie's going to make tons of money. It's well over $300 million going into this weekend. But let me address that superhero fatigue thing. There's, of course, a great statement that many people have made many ways, and they mention this in the movie Air, if you've seen that. The people love to build things up just so they can tear it down. I mean, I remember when the Marvel Cinematic Universe was starting, it was this juggernaut, and everyone was like, oh, this is amazing, look at how great this is, oh, look at this, great, and they supported it, and then Avengers knocked the top off the box office, and everybody was all excited, and then after Endgame, everyone's like, superhero fatigue, and box office pundits, some of them out there are just salivating and waiting for the movies to crash and burn, and they really haven't. There's a dip in the box office, but there's a lot of factors that are involved in that. If you look at some of the dips in the box office, just superhero movies in general, The Batman, which has nothing to do with Marvel, that's a DC movie, that came out last year, and it did very well domestically, but it had a soft overseas run. It did not match the money that was made by The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises. And part of the reason for that is there was COVID. They lost the ability to open it wide in China. China is a huge box office numbers thing. And there's a lot of movies that didn't end up making it in China for various reasons, not just because of content, but because of COVID and lockdowns and restrictions there, that they couldn't get the wide release of that. It impacted the box office. I don't disagree that there are some people that are tired with the Marvel movies, but you can't come out with a movie like this, Guardians of the Galaxy, and make $118 million this opening weekend and be like, oh, people are tired of this. They're not. Part of it is you're not going to get the buildup of right before Endgame. You're not going to get a $2 billion Marvel movie just because Endgame did that well. It all built to that. It's like if you look at the movies leading up to The Avengers, they did fine, but really, you look at the box office for Thor and Captain America, or even The Incredible Hulk. All those pre-Avengers movies were fine for what they are, but it wasn't until Avengers made $200 million this opening weekend did everybody stop and be like, oh, maybe there's something here. And then the movies have done better and better. I think if there's anything to learn is that Marvel probably should be a little more picky about what movies they spend $250 million on. Because when you throw $250 million into a movie, you need it to make like $600, $700, $800 million worldwide just to kind of break even. And that was maybe a foolish thing to do with the Ant-Man and the Wasp movie. Now, Guardians of the Galaxy is going to be fine. They're going to make that number. But you've got to realize that first Ant-Man, when they made that back in, 2015, which, by the way, 2015 was well into the Marvel run. When they made that first Ant-Man movie, I think it cost a little shy of past $100 million. It was like $120, $130 million budget. It's risk and return. It's how much you spend on a movie. It's less superhero fatigue because we've had plenty of movies that don't make $500 million at the box office in the States, but they still do well. It's just you can't spend $250 million on it. And you can't say that there's superhero fatigue because DC's having such trouble. That's a DC problem. Marvel's still doing it. Now, show me the movie outside of Quantumania. Show me the Marvel movie that crashed and burned at the box office. And even then, Quantumania didn't crash and burn. It just was a disappointment. It didn't make the $600 million that they were hoping, but it still made well over $400 million. It's pushing $500 million worldwide. That is not a movie that people didn't want to see. So there probably are people that are tired of the Marvel movies, and they're getting, people are, getting the end of the rope. And there are people that some of these cosmic movies are maybe a little bit too much for them. Yeah. But I still think people are going for the spectacle. I've been saying that for a year and a half. People are going to theaters to see spectacle, whether it's Top Gun Maverick or whether it's Guardians of the Galaxy. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about is for Oppenheimer, which comes to theaters on July 21st.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb, build a town, build it fast. If we don't let scientists bring their families, we'll never get the best.
Why would we go to the middle of nowhere for who knows how long?
How about because this is the most important thing to ever happen in the history of the world?
I'm not as exhausted watching this trailer as I was watching the teasers. Here's the thing. I mean, Christopher Nolan has some really good elements to his filmmaking, but some of his movies are just horribly pretentious. I know I'm holding a knife to the neck of a sacred cow here, but yes, Nolan is pretentious and he's not that good of a storyteller. He can make a really compelling and forceful movie, but some of the stories in his movies, the writing in some of his stories is a mess. And then you like watch this trailer, and I mean that Matt Damon line at the end, he's so serious, this is the most important thing since the history of man. I'm just like, dial it back, Damon. So at least this looks like it's going to have human beings in it, but it looks like there's not a shred of lightheartedness or anything. And I know it's about an atomic bomb, but my God in heaven. The next trailer I want to look at is for The Meg 2, The Trench.
We're detecting increased aquatic activity 25,000 feet deep in the trench. It's an ancient ecosystem untouched by man. Whatever is down there is trying to make its way to the surface.
This was a bad idea.
Just a little bit.
That's the biggest Meg I've ever seen.
Biggest Meg anyone's ever seen.
That's the apex predator.
Everybody make it to the station!
It blows my mind that this movie is existing in this form. This really looks like a Sharknado movie. Maybe the special effects will be a little bit better because they still have time to work on it. But it looks cheesy as all get out. It looks fun, but it looks ridiculous. It looks like something from The Asylum. But then Ben Wheatley's directing it. And Ben Wheatley has some really interesting films under his belt. Now, most people don't know who he is. But he did probably the most recognizable movie he did was this thing called Free Fire a couple years ago with Brie Larson and Armie Hammer. But he'd done some pretty heavy-duty, dark British stuff like Kill List and High Rise and In the Earth. I mean, so he's done some horror type stuff and he's got a dark edge to him. So I'm very curious to see what he does with the comedic element with this movie. I don't know. This thing looks awful, but it looks like exactly the kind of thing you're going to want to see on August 4th. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Rally Road Racers and The Mother.
We'll be right back.
welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's start off with the movie reviews and talk about Rally Road Racers. This is an animated film. It's actually opening wide this week, so you should be able to find it pretty much everywhere. It's a little bit more of an independent release. It's not done by like Pixar or DreamWorks or anything like that. The one reason I think this maybe has a shot at least doing some box office is the Super Mario Brothers has burned off a lot of its box office because it's been making tons and tons of money. And it's just everyone's seen it already. And there's really nothing else out there for kids. So this gives you something. And so let's talk about it. In this animated animal adventure, a young race car driver enters an international race to save his village.
Silk Road Rally.
200 miles per hour for 4 days straight across unforgiving terrain against the craziest drivers in the world.
Oh, it's gonna be epic.
I'm gonna be the champ.
Let's go!
Come on!
Let's rock this party!
Echoes!
Attack!
Let's rock this party!
This is crazy!
There's a whole group of movies where animals are basically human beings living in regular environments, like Zootopia and Sing. Those are the ones that are probably the most well-known. But Rally Road Racers is essentially the same deal, where you've got a bunch of animals and they don't live in a human world. So the movie is about this race car driver, and he's like this little monkey-type thing. It's like a lemur. And he lives in a village, and it's got a Chinese influence to it because he's Chinese. His name is Yi, which is Chinese, and he's voiced by Jimmy O Yang. And they've goes to this international competition, and like the winner for all the races is this toad voiced by John Cleese. And you know, the kid ultimately looks up to him, but then realizes he's really a villain, and the guy's trying to develop the land on his. Where his village is. So, I mean, it uses a lot of these old cliches where he's going up against the big superstar and the superstar's kind of a jerk. And you've got a land baron who's also the superstar trying to displace all of the people who live there. J.K. Simmons plays a goat who is his mechanic slash mentor who gets him into the thing. And when it comes to a movie like this, it's somewhat standard. I mean, yeah, it's animals driving cars, but it's sort of this mashup of, you know, like Zootopia and Speed Racer, where, you know, it's about this race that they're doing. But he also has to learn more about himself, and he's got to become a hero to the people. And there's a girl that he has an interest in, but she has sort of a connection to a nefarious past. But there's a lot of these tropes and archetypes you've seen in animated films before. But I guess it was about halfway through the movie, and they're going through this racing moment, and suddenly it spins off and does this homage to A-ha's video Take On Me from the 80s, which is one of my favorite videos from that era. I don't watch a ton of videos. I did more when I was younger and that came out. But, I mean, that's kind of a deep cut. I mean, a lot of people would recognize it my age, but I'm certain that five-year-olds that are watching this movie aren't going to notice and be like, oh, that's from A-ha back in, what, 1983 or something like that? But it's a great little video, and they really play it off, and they don't just take a nod to it. They do a full scene homage to it. And I'm like, okay, this film has earned some respect from me because it's not just trying to do a stupid kids movie. It's playing off of something for the parents, which I guess is kind of what like Paws of Fury did. It was playing off of Blazing Saddles, but most, you know, a 10-year-old seeing it wouldn't recognize Blazing Saddles because they probably haven't seen Blazing Saddles. So I it has these moments and these bits and pieces of Easter eggs in there that are kind of fun. I mean, the animation's good enough. I mean, I would put it along the level. It was better than Paw Patrol in terms of that movie that they made, the Paw Patrol movie. It's a better animation style, but it's nowhere near the fine-tuned brilliance of DreamWorks or especially Pixar. But it's still fun. I mean, the story goes down a familiar road, but there are some neat Easter eggs in this for the parents. I was pleasantly surprised and I enjoyed it. So, yeah, take the kiddies. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next one I want to talk about is The Mother. Jennifer Lopez plays an assassin who has to protect her daughter after becoming the target of international criminals.
You just gonna vanish?
You put her with good people. Keep her safe. If there's trouble, let me know.
You must have known I'd find her.
The secret's out.
What do they want?
Revenge. They're using her to get to me.
What's your plan?
She needs protection right now.
Who are you?
This is on Netflix, and it's one of their anchor movies that they're sort of launching into the summer with. And I will say one thing. It doesn't quite immediately look like a Netflix movie. There's a certain look to a lot of the cinematography. But I mean, and I like the cinematography you see on Netflix because you can actually see stuff going on. I've complained all the time about the murky, dark cinematography. You see a lot of that on anything horror. So you're going to see that on Shudder. You're going to see the murky cinematography. I see that showing up all the time on Hulu movies. That movie Clock I talked about last week had that to it. But this one, it has a good cinematography, but it's a little bit different. It doesn't quite look like their standard pieces. It looks more like there was that movie. It was that Sandra Bullock movie, and it was on Netflix, The Unforgivable. So it looks like that, where it's still well-lit, but it has a different color scheme. So, I mean, it works and it looks good as a movie. And actually, Jennifer Lopez does a decent job as sort of this formidable assassin, highly trained ex-military, usually a kind of character like this. This would have been played by Arnold Schwarzenegger back in the 80s, but Jennifer Lopez, 5'2", Jennifer Lopez is playing. But I think she pulls it off, and I give her credit. I think she actually comes across as the badass, which is not something everybody can do. And this isn't even a gender thing, because I've seen guys who are trying to achieve this, and they just look silly. Jessica Chastain Zero Dark Thirty. She tries to be like yelling it just doesn't work for her. But Jennifer Lopez pulls this off. And when it comes to sort of that action spy movie, it has actually some pretty nice action set pieces, some really nice action sequences. Well, I mean, it's not rivaling James Bond, but it's certainly given a go at trying to do that sort of international James Bond type of stuff. Like there's a whole thing in the snow with snowmobiles, and that's very much a James Bond thing. There's a road chase somewhere in I think it's in Germany, but it works as an action movie, and it works as that darker revenge story. The writing's really clunky, but the problem is the whole thing is she had to give up the baby, and she's been trying to keep tabs on it, and then she knew the bad guys were going to come after the baby, and the girl's like 12, and so she's basically trying to keep her safe, but the girl doesn't know what the heck's going on. And it works, but it gets to this point in the middle of it where it just comes to a screeching halt. The writing, I mean, talk about it, it turns into a totally different movie. And it's very jarring, and then it kind of gets back to where it's supposed to be. But it has this crater in the middle of it that is really hard to get through. So some really clunky writing. It has some decent action set pieces, but the narrative stumbles hard in the middle. It runs too long, too. So I'm going to be nice and say, I mean, it was at least enjoyable to watch, but you're going to get distracted while you watch it. So I'll give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Book Club, The Next Chapter, and BlackBerry.
Pump up the jam, pump it up, why you...
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Let's talk about Book Club, The Next Chapter. I know this is not my kind of movie necessarily. And I know there are people out there who hate Jane Fonda. I do call-ins to some radio stations. I won't tell you what station it was. But the host, who was he was an older host and, staunch conservative Republican. And he hated Jane Fonda. I'm not saying I'm a fan of Jane Fonda. She was in a movie that week. I mean, it was years ago. It was that one she did with Adam Driver was in it and Jason Bateman, and they were sitting Shiva over, like, she was widowed. And the guy literally almost walked out of the studio because I was talking about a movie about Jane Fonda. And I'm like, look, man, she's in a movie. I have to talk about it. So book club, the next chapter, they did a first one in 2018. I didn't realize it was 5 years ago, but yeah, it was 5 years ago. So that one did quite well. It was a little bit of a surprise hit. So they have to make another one because they made money. So after the pandemic lockdown, four friends from a book club plan on a once-in-a-lifetime trip to Italy.
What? Oh, my God. You're engaged?
Oh, when did this happen?
It was last night.
You know what that means?
Bachelorette.
The book says we can't reject our destiny, and I think we should all go to Italy.
Italy?
We might never have a chance to do something like this again.
Rome, Roma, I love this city.
I love anything that's falling apart more than I am.
The movie stars, as I mentioned, Jane Fonda, and her character is the one that's getting married, and she's the confirmed bachelorette, who is very nervous about settling down in her 70s. But it also stars Diane Keaton. She's a widow, and she's dating Andy Garcia, his character, but she is still sort of dealing with the death of her husband. You've got Mary Steenburgen, who's kind of got the most grounded story in the film. She is married to a character played by Craig T. Nelson, who's had heart issues. And she's nervous going to Europe and leaving him at home. She doesn't want him to have any problems, but it's also them needing to kind of find a new path in their life with him having, you know, heart issues and restrictions on just diet and exercise. And then you have Candace Bergen, who plays a retired judge. And what's funny about her role is she's just kind of there as a comedic wild card. She is not there to have a big story or a big arc. She's the Samantha of this group, to talk in terms of Sex and the City. I know, I hate myself that I can talk in terms of Sex and the City and say who's Samantha and who's the Charlotte. But that's the four of them, and they've never been to Italy together, so they go to Italy, and it's just them having a nice little romp. It's just them having a fun time getting into these misadventures. And you know, I can respect that because not every movie, especially movie for, let's just say, a movie for women of a certain age. If you're past your 30s and 40s, you are probably more interested in this movie than, you know, the college kids. But so many movies for the older generation are depressing, dour movies where you're forced to look at your own mortality. Look at your own mortality. And I mean, that's a real thing and you got to do it. But what's wrong with just having a fun time? And the other thing, what's great about not just women at this age, but men, you get to the point that when you're in your 70s, you don't care. You're just like, I don't care. You know, I'm not worried about what other people are thinking. I'm just going to go do it. You know, when you're in your 20s and your 30s, certainly when you're in your teens, you're a little more concerned about what people think of you. But once you get into the golden years and beyond, you're looking at this and saying, okay, I don't care. I'm going to go do this anyways. And it's a fun little road trip movie, but it feels like kind of one of those. I've said this about Adam Sandler. He'll make these movies. I know you never think I'd speak about Adam Sandler in reference to Book Club, but his movies are essentially these silly little movies that take place in a wonderful location, and it's just an excuse for him and his friends to go kind of have a vacation and then shoot a movie for a couple days. And that's kind of what I feel like with this movie. And I'm like, hey, you know, it's completely harmless and it's sweet. It's very funny. They've all got chemistry and they all kind of play to their roles. You know, Jane Fonda, well, she's kind of more the Samantha as the sexy Samantha. Candace Bergen, her character is she's the wisecracker. So if you go for the Golden Girls thing, I think she falls a little bit more into the Sophia category. Again, I can categorize characters based on either the Golden Girls or Sex and the City. But Mary Steenburgen, she's kind of more of a grounded character, having a realistic story. And Diane Keaton is kind of her quirky self. They let her be quirky Diane Keaton, which I think is kind of cute. It's fine. It has some raunchy humor, which is great. Candace Bergen throws in a lot of it. And it's kind of like 80 for Brady. You remember that there's a reason these women are all movie stars. So look, you know, it's a whimsical and entertaining, not a little bit corny, comedy about women still looking for friendship and adventure. And even though I'm not a woman of that age, I still found it charming and fun. So, yeah, I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about BlackBerry. This docudrama examines the rise and fall of the BlackBerry smartphone.
I know how to market it, and I know who we can sell it to. But I want 50% of the company, and I've got to be CEO.
I don't know who you think you are, but
deal.
Are you joking?
We are in a race to get this thing to market, and we are a year behind. I need a prototype.
I'll do it perfectly, or I don't do it. What do you call it?
It's called a BlackBerry.
Huh. Try typing with your thumbs.
Get this baby in the hands of every Fortune 500 executive you can find.
We call them crackberries.
First of all, I didn't even realize they really don't make BlackBerries anymore. But apparently, I mean, it's crashed completely. But I've never had a BlackBerry. My very first smartphone I got was an iPhone. It was like an iPhone 3. In fact, I need to get a new phone. My phone right now is, I think I got an iPhone 7. I mean, it's like old and it's cracked. I dropped it when I was in New York and hit the ground. And, you know, I'm like a teenager with it. But I never had a BlackBerry. I knew people who had them and I knew people who were addicted to them. And I know that they really sort of dominated the market, but they were usurped by Apple, which is kind of what Apple does sometimes. That's technology. You know, just because you're first to market with something or you're the first person to be popular with it does not mean it's going to sustain. Now, the movie BlackBerry is similar to Air and Tetris. There are two movies that were sort of period pieces about some development that was innovative. You know, in Air, it was about the development of the Air Jordan, and not just the development of the shoe, but how you got Michael Jordan tied into it. And in terms of Tetris, it was about the development of this game and getting it out of Russia. And they both have a certain level of nostalgia to it, and this one certainly does as well. It's a little bit closer to us time-wise because I think it starts like right at the tail end of the 90s and it goes into the 2000s until about 2007. 2008 is where sort of like the climax happens. But it's that look into the past and it has that dreary sort of, looks like it was shot on VHS at times or a very grainy 90s independent film type quality to it. And that works for the nostalgia. I think they lean a little bit too far into the nostalgia where it almost looks like, and you're watching this going, this is just 15 years ago. You know, it wasn't like an alien world at that point, but it plays around with that. But it's a scintillating story because you have these extreme characters. You have the people who developed the BlackBerry. And those are the engineers, the nerds. And then you have Glenn Howerton. He's the shark who kind of is able to market it. And neither entity would have been able to do anything without each other, but they were completely at odds because they're such different types of people. And it's fascinating. I don't know how much has taken some creative liberties because I know it's based on a book, but it's incredibly entertaining to watch, mainly because you get to see these extreme personalities and what happens to them and the real story behind the rise and fall of the BlackBerry popularity is fascinating. You know, I mean, it's an extreme look at extreme characters with necessary personality clashes and some incredible performances. I'm going to say that BlackBerry totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Crater and the home cinema roundup featuring The Hobbit. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews and talk about Crater. This is on Disney Plus. This coming-of-age sci-fi adventure follows a group of teens from a lunar mining colony as they escape the dome to find a special message for their friend.
Whatever's out there, your dad wants you to see it.
We've never even been outside the dome before.
So what's it gonna be?
We're leaving tonight.
I hear she's weird.
Why?
Earth.
So?
The peculiar.
You're peculiar.
All in favor? Let's go steal a rover.
Yeah! You know the best thing about road trips? You get to leave everything behind.
Caleb,
What's in the crater?
I don't know.
When Disney Plus started, and I started to look at some of the content that was coming out of it, I remember one of the earlier films that they did was this one called Godmothered. Jillian Bell plays a fairy godmother in training. I was really noticing that the content they're pushing onto Disney Plus is very different from the content going on the Disney Channel, the classic Disney Channel series. Disney Channel series were like all for preteens, 9 to 12 year olds. And that's the market. And they did very well in that market. And then the market grew out of it and they didn't try to sustain anything beyond that. The films they do in Disney Plus now tend to have a little wider of a net. They're not just for a very specific, like, girls 9 to 12 age group. This is meant to be a little bit more of a coming of age for a general story. And I think that's good because you get better movies that way. Because, you know, if all you're doing is focusing on those 9 to 12, that's how you get Hannah Montana and That's So Raven and Sweet Life with Zach and Cody. But you can get a little bit more richer stories. And while this is kind of just a very typical coming of age story, and it takes place on this lunar colony, and they're all miners. The families are miners on the moon, and they've lived there their whole lives. They've never been to Earth. There's one girl who's just come from Earth because her parents have gotten divorced. But they become friends, and one of the kids, his father died in a mining accident. His mother had died years before. And since he's an orphan on the colony, they're going to ship him off to their utopian space colony that's like 75 years away that they have to put you in suspended animation for. But what's neat about it is it's a traditional sci-fi story. I mean, it's about kids. It's a coming-of-age story. It's about friendship. It doesn't have that same click as like an Amblin film from the 80s. But they're also not trying to hit all the sort of the stereotypes and the archetypes. Each kid is a little bit different, but they're not giant cliches. And like one of the kids is the girl, like the one who I said who came from Earth. Her father has access codes so they can escape. And that's how they kind of bring her along. And she's played by McKenna Grace, who's got quite a career. She does some good stuff. She was in the Ghostbusters reboot. And it's ultimately about a group of friends taking a road trip, and they just have to be on the moon. But it's an interesting perspective, because growing up as a kid, I would have loved to have lived on the moon. But if all you know is the moon, it's probably not that great, especially if you're just living in a mining colony. I mean, the gee whiz factor is gone, because that's where you grew up. And they've never been to Earth, so that's how they deal with it. It still finds the human story, even literally on another, it's not another planet, but on a different world, so to speak. And you've got the kids saying goodbye to their friend because they know he's going to be going off to this colony. He's going to be asleep for 75 years. And sort of their last hurrah. And it's him looking into his life. And by doing this, and because you've got some heavier subject matter, like the death of the mother, which is, that's in every Disney movie, to be honest. But, and the father having just died, you know, an orphaned kid. It's dealing with some heavier topics. It's like I said, it's not just a That's So Raven story. It deals with real life issues, even though it's in a sci-fi environment. But it's safe for kids to watch because it's not punishing or brutal or anything like that. It's just there are some bad things that have happened and people deal with it. And even as the movie plays out, one of the things I really appreciated about it is it wasn't simple. It didn't have this easy ending. I mean, there's some stuff that's a little bit corny and cliche and too perfect at times. But overall, it gives a look at something by saying, this is the situation you're in, and it's not exactly how you want it to be, but that's life. That's what life throws at you. And I think that gives a good tone at the end. I mean, it's touching and it's well-balanced. This offers some friendship comfort without getting too silly. I really enjoyed Crater. I was surprised. I'm going to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent! Yay!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on The Hobbit. No, not the Peter Jackson movies. Although I do enjoy those movies. And I've said this to people before. I actually like The Hobbit movies more than The Lord of the Rings movies. I know. Blasphemy. But the Lord of the Rings movies get a little bit too serious at times. There's a whimsy to the Hobbit movies. They're overblown and too big, but I find them more fun. But my first introduction to The Hobbit, I don't remember when this was first broadcast on TV in the 70s, but I remember my first real awareness of it was I was in the fifth grade, so it would have been right around 1980, so it's been a couple years after that. And this, they played periodically on TV, and I remember I caught it on TV. This animated TV version of J.R.R. Tolkien's classic novel finds a group of dwarves joining forces with a wizard and a hobbit to regain their kingdom.
In a time when the earth was shared by wizards, goblins, trolls, dragons, and hobbits.
Most excellent hobbit.
A reluctant hobbit.
We hobbits are plain, quiet folk. Adventures make one late for dinner.
Would become a legendary hero.
Who are you and where do you come from?
I am Mr. Bilbo Baggins.
It's a fantastic journey through a magic kingdom.
Simply enchanting.
J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit.
What's fascinating going back and watching this is I've read the book The Hobbit, but I've also seen the movies. I think I retain more from the movies because there's more. It's visually there. And when I read the book after I saw Peter Jackson's adaptations of it, so it just sort of mirrored and filled in the gaps of a lot of stuff, even though there's more content in the movies, I think. But I never read the book as a kid, but I remember seeing the movie, and it surprises me how relatively close the adaptations are. This and the Peter Jackson versions, they both try to give a true adaptation of the book. Oh, now this thing's short. It's like, I don't know, 75 minutes because it was a TV movie. And it's done by Rankin Bass, and there you might know their names because they did all these Christmas specials. They did like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Frosty the Snowman. They did that stop motion stuff, but they also did some hand cell animation stuff like the Twas the Night Before Christmas. They did a lot of animation for holiday specials, and they did the animation for this, and it has that rustic, I guess, kind of like, you know, almost bulbous animation that you'd see. It seems very 70s art style. It's sort of this very rustic and sketchy look. But it hits all the points. You know, it's got Gollum in there. It's got Smaug. It's got the goblins. And so it hits all the points. And the adventure, it's actually a pretty good adaptation. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed watching this because I remember as a kid, not understanding Tolkien that much, but when I saw it, like when I was like 9 or 10, I still enjoyed it because, you know, it had spiders and dragons in it. But it was kind of impressive to watch in light of the huge movies that they spent so much money on. And it reminded me of how breezy you can make this story and how quickly you can move through it. So, it was on HBO Max. I believe you can still get it. I don't know if they're going to take it off at any point. I don't actually know who owns the rights to it. I don't know if it's a Warner Brothers property. But if you've ever watched the trilogy that Peter Jackson directed, I mean, the Hobbit trilogy, this is worth seeing just for anything, for comparison. It's for the fact that it's shorter, it doesn't feel like it's condensed. It doesn't feel like they're rushing it. And that's because I think this was made first. It's not like they were trying to cram everything that we saw in the movies into it. They streamlined the story pretty well. And it works. It's a great little nostalgic piece of animation from the 70s. I mean, it's quick and it's breezy compared to the live action films, but this offers a good introduction to on-screen Tolkien lore. And I would say it's better than the animated Lord of the Rings movie that they did where they kind of split it into two and they never ended up making the second half. I think The Hobbit is a better animated film. So I'm going to have to say that this totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And that's it. I need to go. Next week I'm going to be talking about Fast X, the movie, not the heartburn medicine. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.